We're reading today from the 11th Canto, chapter 2, text 22. Vishaya bine abine veshenah. Natmanam vedana param. Vriksha jivitya vyajivan. Vyartam vastre vayasva svatman. Vishaya vinniveshenah. Natmanam vedana param. Vriksha jivitava jivan. Vyartam vasteva yasvasan. Vishaya. With sense gratification. Abhini Vishena. By absorption, by over-absorption. Na, not. Atmanam, himself. Veda, knows. Na, nor. Aparam, another. Vriksha, of a tree. Jivakaya, by the lifestyle. Jivan, living. Vyartam, in vain. Vastra eva, just like a bellow. Ya, who, svasan, is breathing. Translation. The thought of absorption in sense gratification. One cannot recognize himself or others. Living uselessly in ignorance like a tree, one is merely breathing just like a bellows. Please repeat. Because of absorption in sense gratification. One cannot recognize himself or others. Living uselessly, in ignorance, like a tree, one is merely breathing, just like a bellows. Just as trees, having no means to defend themselves, are always being cut down. Similarly, the conditioned souls are constantly being cut down by the cruel laws of nature, which impose innumerable miseries, culminating in sudden death. Although foolish people think they are helping themselves and others, they actually do not know their own identity, nor the identities of their so-called friends and relatives. Absorbed in gratifying the senses of the external body, they spend their lives uselessly without any spiritual profit. This useless lifestyle can be transformed into a perfect life simply by chanting the holy names of God in Krishna consciousness, as recommended by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Om Aginati Mahandasya Ginagina Salataya Chakshu Unmilitam Jaina Tasmai Sri Guruvay Namaha. So this verse carries a very vivid, the purport carries a very vivid picture, because we see all around us trees, I noticed when I was coming back to the temple last night, there were so many tree branches out the back, because for some reason or another they had been chopped. And it's so common to chop down trees for good reason or bad reason. So everyone has seen a tree being chopped or a tree that has been chopped. So it's something in our range of experience, seeing a tree chopped. Just imagine that we're being compared to that. Our life is being compared to that. It's getting chopped down. Either you get the branches chopped off, you have some plan, some hope, and the nature of life is that it doesn't always go your way. Sometimes it goes your way and you feel like in a casino. You play a game, and a few times it goes your way, and that gets you started. That's like you power a pump. You put some water through the pump to begin with to get the pump to be working. So they're very clever, the personalities who are taking charge of these various mechanisms. They know how to get people overly excited about what they're experiencing, and then they'll try again. And then the recommendation is, oh, you didn't get it right this time. Last time you did, remember? So you better try again. And so they try again. And the foolish living entities, we see them around us in so many different situations when we're going here and there and doing things. They can't understand that their life is being chopped, like the branches of the tree are chopped. And neither can they understand that when death comes, it's like, whoosh, right at the base, the tree is cut, and the whole thing is over. Neither they understand while they're alive, neither they understand when they're dead, obviously. And neither do they understand next birth. So sometimes, if we're in a thoughtful mood, we can see that this still has a lingering value for us, that we also can fall victim of this kind of thinking. Just as when you have a dream and you wake up, when you first wake up, you're still in touch with the dream. You can still remember, oh, I was having such a nice dream. I had so much money. I was doing so many things. Oh, okay, what's my time? Oh, well, I'm late. Okay, and then we start on with our day. So in the same way for us as devotees, these things are still lingering around. And but as the message is given to us, the message of positive perfection, by taking shelter of the chanting of the processes of Krishna consciousness, we can perfect this life. And Srila Prabhupada was very, very firm on this point. You can perfect this life. And someone may say, oh, I'm so old. How can I perfect this life? If I had started as a baby in the right environment, with the right parents and the right situation, then I could perfect my life. But now, what's the hope for me? But Prabhupada never thought like that. He always thought, no, no, wherever you are, whatever your situation is, you can perfect your life. So even if somebody was very on in their life, maybe you can't perfect your life in the next 5 years, as you may have already deduced. Okay, I've performed 5 years of devotional service, my life is not yet perfect, so probably in the next 5 years my life won't also be perfect. But you see, we're on a path. It's called the path of perfection. And whatever we tread of that path, is that much closer we are to perfection. So there used to be, I remember, perhaps in the 80s, after Srila Prabhupada had left because, or disappeared from our vision, because when Srila Prabhupada was present amongst us, he kept the fire burning, very hot. We'd come to Srila Prabhupada and say, Srila Prabhupada, we've done such and such scores of book distribution, and what would he say? That's wonderful. Or he would say, double it. And everyone would say, double it. We just worked so hard. But Srila Prabhupada said, double it. Because he was keeping the fire very hot. He was keeping our enthusiasm and the demands upon us very high. And it was very exciting, although there was oftentimes casualties, and those who weren't so strong as to be able to have done it to begin with, when Prabhupada said double it, they might collapse by the wayside. But so the Prabhupada was focusing on this. You could say if you're lighting a fire, burning something, the things on the side, they may not burn now, they may have to burn later, but you keep the fire very hot in the center. So Srila Prabhupada was doing that, soaking the fire, so our enthusiasm, our sense of urgency was very prominent. And then after Srila Prabhupada left, what to do then? It was quite difficult because he had had everybody overextended beyond their normal capacities, and now the person who was the executor of this powerful thrust was no longer physically present. And so quite naturally what people did was they returned to normal, much closer to what their normal capacity would be. And some people, they got lost in different ways of thinking, and they reduced their devotional service, and all sorts of theories started to kind of infiltrate. Theories such as, and a really classic one, which I don't hear so much now because the fire isn't as hot as it was with Srila Prabhupada, but people started to say this openly, that I thought when Prabhupada was here that I was going to go back to Godhead quite soon because he had us working so hard. It must be that it's going to just be around the corner. And now I'm seeing it's going to take me more time. So I'm thinking, since it's going to take me more time to go back to Godhead, I should go a bit slower. And this is what people always say this. I thought I should go a bit slower. You can't be sort of running when it's going to take a long time. Now, when you think about that, that's not logical. This is one of those sort of illogical ways that we convince ourselves that if I think like this, I'm still doing the same thing I was when I was thinking in a very focused way. I'm just doing it slower. The logical way to think, not an illogical way, is that if it's going to take more time, if the pathway is a lot longer between here and the city, and I'm walking to the city, I don't say, okay, it's going to take a bit longer to get to the city, so let me walk slower. It's going to take a lot longer still. I say instead, okay, let me concentrate on this. I have to walk. Let me keep my mind on the job. I've got to keep walking. And I focus more on my walk. Or if I'm an experienced walker, I just go on to automatic. I just get my legs walking, and my legs are walking in the right direction, and then I can think of other things as I'm walking, things that I'll do when I get there. So this is also true in the Krishna consciousness process, that we shouldn't say such illogical things to ourselves and others, that it's going to take a while, so I'm going to go slow. We should say it may take a while, and so I should get as much done in this life as I can. I should get as much done today as I can. And today might not be the best day for me. Today I'm having a bad day. Oh, but then there's tomorrow, so I should get as much done tomorrow as I can. And we should keep in that mentality. I should get as much done as I can. And if you think like that, lo and behold, you're walking along, so many inconveniences, but you know where you're going, you just keep walking. And somehow or another, you look back after a certain amount of time and you realize, oh, I've gone a long way. I'm very, very far away than where I was about an hour ago. An hour ago I was sitting in my nice warm house, and now I'm almost there. So this is the positive nature of Krishna consciousness, and yet, to induce us to walk, to keep walking, we have to hear of the negative nature of the material world, and the negative nature of being in the bodily concept of life. And if we have to sadly admit to ourselves, but not to others, that I'm still in the bodily concept of life, what do I do? And there's a very good answer to that also. You should spend as much time as you're able, and if it's not very much, you should make it more, reading the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because the Srimad Bhagavatam will take you up like an elevator. above all the difficulties that you're facing in your life, and will allow you to look down from above and they look much smaller. Rather than what is the common materialistic tendency of our nature, to just get absorbed in them, or think that we'll solve them, or think that somebody else should be solving them, or think so many things. But we should actually come up, and as we come up, we'll be very much relieved and we'll be very much grateful, and we'll recognize the value that the Srimad Bhagavatam can offer to us. I was talking recently in Perth to one older devotee. His wife one day said to him, "I want to leave you." And he was very shocked. It wasn't expected by him. And she said, "You know, I haven't had a life, and I want to have a life, and I can't have a life with you being my husband all the time. I feel guilty." Bad logic again. "I feel guilty that you're my husband and I can't enjoy in the same way, because I'll hurt you. So I want to leave you." This is actually how we talk to Krishna. So she says, "So I want to leave you. I hope you don't mind. I want to nullify the marriage." So he was very, very disturbed. And he said to us when he was talking, he said, I almost contemplated suicide because it was unexpected that my wife would do this to me. And I thought to myself, who gives me comfort? Because in such a difficult moment, you turn to who gives you comfort. And he said, "My grandson, he's so jolly, he's so beautiful, he's so peaceful. I thought, I'll go and see him. We have such a close relationship." And he said to me himself, I got there, I picked him up, I played with him a little bit, and it didn't bring me any comfort at all. And then I went back home, and I picked up the Srimad Bhagavatam. And I started reading and reading and reading in my distress, and I felt completely comforted, and I understood where my protection lay. I understood who is my protector, and somehow or another, even though I should be completely cut apart, I'm completely peaceful. And I said to her, "You do whatever you need to do. Whatever you need, I want you to do that." And all of a sudden she said to me, "Oh, you've made me more guilty." And this is what Krishna does with us. He says, "You do whatever you need to do." And then we feel, because of our own wrongness of choice, not exactly wrong in a biblical sense, in a moral sense, but wrong like a choice that's not going to bring you any happiness. We've made choices that aren't going to bring us happiness. It's the wrong choice. If you're going up a one-way street, you've made a wrong choice. It's existentially wrong, not morally wrong. It's wrong. So we've made a wrong choice. We said, "I'll be happy if I have this, this, and this, and I go there, there, and there, and I enjoy that, that, and that." So we've done this to ourselves. And when Krishna says, "Yes, you do whatever you want, you have my blessings, I'm always here. You, if you want to come back, if anything goes wrong, you come back straight to me." But you find out for yourself if you can actually be happy in the material sense. So her heart, because it was covered, not in good form, she was saying to him, "Well, now you've made me feel more guilty. Now I feel awful. Now I'm confused. Now I have not even got enough strength to do what I wanted to do. You spoiled it." And he said, no, go, do what you want to do." So her day of arrival was coming to leave on the aeroplane. And she was getting more and more shaky at the knees and more indecisive and more worried. But she still got on the aeroplane because she knew she had to. And when she got on the aeroplane, she found seated somewhere on the plane was another devotee. And they said, "Where are you going?" And she said, "I'm going to America." And they said, "Oh," and she told them where she was going, and they said, "Oh, do you know that there's a temple there?" She said, "Really? I had no idea there was a temple there," because her mind was focused differently. And the devotee said to her, "Yes, there's a temple there. And do you know who's staying there right now?" She said, "No, who?" And they said, "Your spiritual master." "How long are you going to be there?" "2 weeks." How long is he going to be there? 2 weeks. So then she rang her husband on the plane and said, you know what happened? So because he stayed firm in his faith in the Srimad Bhagavatam, his wife took her risky journey, but because she's actually sincere, she wants to be a devotee, but she has all these things that are going on as well. And Krishna's just saying, tapping her on the shoulder, don't worry, I'm taking care of you. So we want to be like that. We want to be either taking shelter of the Srimad Bhagavatam and very intelligent, or if they're not so intelligent, we want to feel that Krishna is saying, I'm taking care of you. You're doing the wrong thing. You can never be happy, but I'll go with you and I'll take care of you. And when you recognize that, oh my goodness, I've done such a silly thing, then you just come with me and I'll show you the way home. You can get back on that path to liberation again, and off we'll go, but this time you should move a little faster. Don't go too slow. If you go too slow, you might get distracted. You might catch a cold of material disease and then get some new attachments or desires that really, really, really aren't going to help you. So please, for all of these practicing devotees, all of you who are present, study the Srimad Bhagavatam. If you can't study the Srimad Bhagavatam, then just read the Bhagavatam. Just pick it up anywhere, open the pages, until you find something that strikes you. A word, a sentence, a verse, and just read the Bhagavatam even randomly. Because Srila Prabhupada said that the Bhagavatam is like a big laddu, a big sweet. Wherever you take a little bit, it will be sweet. Obviously, this doesn't mean that we shouldn't study the Srimad Bhagavatam scientifically. But alongside of our steady study, we shouldn't think of the Bhagavatam as something we only study. It should be something that is like the Bhagavatam becomes our friend. And so with a very close friend, whenever there's a problem, you go to your friend and say, oh, I'm having a problem today, please help me. And you stay with your friend until there's some remedy occurs from the shelter of the Bhagavatam. So last time I was here, I was asked to give class in the previous chapter, which is called True Devotional Service. And it was interestingly enough a section that for many, many years I found a real shelter in, because it was explaining how to control the mind. And it was explaining how a devotee who's a neophyte devotee can pray. Because a neophyte devotee means I'm still fully absorbed in the material world, but I've come to understand that it's not good for me, but there's nothing I can do about it. I'm still fully absorbed in it. Whereas an advanced devotee doesn't pray like that. During the weekend at the retreat, we were hearing how an advanced devotee prays to Shishi Radha Balava. And they don't pray like that. They say such things as, oh, lifter of Govardhan Hill. Oh, he who enjoys pastimes with the gopis. Oh, he who is far away from the material mind, I constantly worship and serve you. So that may not be our prayer. We may have a different prayer. So in this section of the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a wonderful prayer. So you should know these places. Look them up. Find them, because they'll be helpful to you. Here, he says, Srila Sukadeva Goswami, I think he's speaking, says that this is a prayer. By my previous shameful life, my heart is polluted with many illusory attachments. Personally, I have no power to stop them. Only Lord Krishna within my heart can remove such inauspicious contamination. But whether the Lord removes such attachments immediately or lets me go on being afflicted by them, I will never give up my devotional service to Him. Even if the Lord places millions of obstacles in my path, and even if, because of my offenses, I have to go to hell. I will never for a moment stop serving Lord Krishna. I am not interested in mental speculation and fruitive activities, and even if Lord Brahma personally comes before me offering me such engagements, I will be not even slightly interested. This is the path especially for us. Although I am attached to material things, I can see very clearly that they lead to no good, but they simply give me trouble and disturb my devotional service to the Lord. Therefore, I sincerely repent my foolish attachments to so many material things, and I am patiently waiting Lord Krishna's mercy. This is such a wonderful prayer. It's a touch above us still, because we cannot say in all honesty, I will never give up my service, because so many times in the day we drift off back into something else. But we can say that even though I'm still attached to so many things, I'm beginning to see that they don't actually do me any good. They're not actually helping me. And I'm sorry that I can't do anything about it. I'm sincerely sorry that I cannot give up these attachments. So this is part of the Uddhava Gita, this section of the Srimad Bhagavatam, as you must all know. And this is Krishna speaking to Uddhava. And at this time, this is after the 11th canto, of course, is after the 10th canto. And so, by the end of the 10th canto, Krishna is already considering his departure from this world. And Uddhava was extremely grief-stricken because Krishna requested Uddhava to stay on and to perform some service on his behalf. And Uddhava couldn't bear this thought because the intimacy of love between Uddhava and Krishna was like as if you have two souls in one body. How close, or the intimacy between our intelligence and our mind. You hear them always chattering away to each other. So it's so intimate, so closely connected, vitally connected, was Uddhava and Krishna. And Krishna asked Uddhava to do a very special service also. He asked him to go to Vrindavan and bring a message to save the life of the residents of Vrindavan. And actually, Uddhava explains when he comes back that the reason that Krishna asked me to go to Vrindavan and see the residents of Vrindavan was because he knew that I was a little proud. Because I'm so close to him, I'm his advisor, I'm always with him, he takes so much counsel from me, we're so intimate. He knew, in my heart, I was a little proud, and I was thinking, because people said it to me all the time, oh, you are so intimate to Krishna, you are the greatest devotee, and so many things like that. He knew that, and so he wanted me to see what real devotion was. And so he sent me there. And when I saw the depth of the love of the residents of Vrindavan for Krishna, even I, who am the personal associate of Krishna, I couldn't leave. Even though nothing would separate me from Krishna's service, this separated me. For months I stayed there, observing them, seeing how deeply they loved Krishna. They love Krishna so much that they think that they are Krishna sometimes. Or they think that Krishna comes in the form of a bee. And they chastise the bee and say, "You're a useless messenger from a rascal master. Why have you come here? Don't touch me. Don't come anywhere near me. I don't even want to see you. Your master said this, 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 this." Now, if this was going on in a movie here, a cinematographical love scene, the girl would be all in up in arms and anger about herself and how she's been mistreated, and the man would be considered a rascal because she's thinking of her pleasure, he's thinking of his pleasure, he's found another girl, she's left behind, oh, and we'd all be angry at him, right? And we'd think, typical man. Look, he didn't take care of his wife, and so on. But this is not like that. These are the madnesses of Srimati Radharani's love, because she's 100% absorbed in Krishna, constantly thinking about Krishna. And Krishna sends a message to her, just fix your mind on me. And she says, what kind of message is this? This is a message for a third class person who can't fix his mind on you. Can you tell me how I can unfix my mind on you? Because day and night, moment by moment, second by second, eternally, I'm constantly thinking of you, what you're doing, whether you're happy or not. Why are you there? We make you more happy. We love you more. You should be here so we can serve you with our love. And then she says so many things to the bee, criticizing the bee, useless messenger, so on and so forth. And then in her madness, transcendental madness, she thinks, oh my goodness, the bee has disappeared. He must have gone back to Krishna. Oh, what will Krishna think when he hears this message? Oh, Krishna's heart will be wounded by my words. Oh, and then the bee comes back. Oh, it's so nice to see you. I'm so happy to see you. Have you brought a message from Krishna? Please sit down and tell me the message. And Uddhava is just watching this. And Uddhava's love never makes him lose his balance. This is called Vaidhi Bhakti. He never goes out of the realm of his intelligence. He's always in control of his intelligence and he knows just what he's doing and so forth. But Radharani's love makes her like mad. There's no control over her mind, her thoughts, her feelings, her heart. But it's not like a mad person who has no control in this world, because there's only one thing that she's thinking about, and that's Krishna. And so that difference of only being Krishna there instead of only being me there or madness there makes this the topmost emotional state in the range of prema bhakti. Only Srimati Radharani can reach that. And it explains in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita that one other person could experience that. Do we know who that is? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. There is one other person. Do you know who that is? Yes, Madhavendra Puri. And so as we were hearing in our reading the other evening, we were hearing the reading about when Lord Chaitanya went to Vrindavan, and he was in Mathura, and he was dancing in great happiness. And there was one Brahmana came, and he also was dancing in the same happiness. And so Lord Chaitanya noted this. How is he experiencing the same sentiments that I am? He's got the same mood as me. And so later he spoke to him and said, asked him about himself, where did you, who are you, what? And he told him, he said, sir, Madhavendra Puri, he came to my house. And when he came to my house, I fed him and he initiated me. And so I recognize in you that only you have seen who is anything like Madhavendra Puri. And so you must have a connection with Madhavendra Puri. And Lord Chaitanya said, I saw you and knew you had a connection with Madhavendra Puri. So just like if on a very, very, very lesser level, on a very small level, when we're somewhere out in the city or something and you hear the Harinam party going, and immediately you come out of the shop and you see them maybe at a distance and the sound of the kirtans just sounds so wonderful because it comes from another dimension. And somehow or other, for your work or something, you're busy with all these other things that are around you. But this floats in, and immediately we identify with that. So in the same way, these two personalities, great personalities, could understand the mood of Srimati Radharani. So this is the topmost level, and Uddhava saw this. And Krishna sent Uddhava there also for another reason. Because he reveals in his instructions to Uddhava before he goes, he tells him that the gopis are all together. So when they miss me, they support each other. And here I am in Mathura. Who am I going to talk to? Am I going to talk to the queens? At night when Krishna's sleeping, he's having dreams and he's saying, oh, stop that. Oh, you naughty. He's saying so many things about Vrindavan because he's dreaming constantly about Vrindavan. But when he wakes up, he has to do everything as a dutiful husband. In Dwarka, am I going to tell Vasudeva and Devaki that I'm thinking of Vrindavan? They're going to immediately think, oh my goodness, Krishna will leave us. And they'll get in so much anxiety. Oh, and they have to reinforce their explanation to him of how he's their son. He's not Nandanyasoda's son. He was just planted there for some time, but no, you're our son. They'll become so worried. So Krishna says, no, I cannot speak to them. Who will understand? Who is there? So sometimes he can speak to Balaram, but Balaram is his brother, and he's a respectable elder. So Krishna sends Uddhava and says, you go and have a look at this. And then you can be my confidant when I tell you how much I miss the residents of Vrindavan. So this is behind. And in fact, we're hearing the instructions that are being presented to Uddhava that he should present in the form of the Srimad Bhagavatam his dialogues, which have been spoken by Sukadev, Goswami, and then Vyasadeva has written them down. These should be present for us who have wandered off to the left and the right from the true path of what life is meant to lead, or where life is meant to lead us, and to reclaim these souls, because Krishna is always thinking of everyone, not only thinking of his own pleasure, which is internal and very profound, but thinking also of those living entities who are not with him right now. He's with them, but they're not with him. He wants us also to return and come back. So here, in this particular chapter, this Vedic path, which you read in the beginning of this verse, of this chapter, Krishna says, those who give up these methods of achieving me, which consist of devotional service, analytical philosophy, and regulated execution of prescribed duties, and instead of doing those things, regulating their senses, being philosophically thoughtful, and serving Krishna, instead they cultivate insignificant sense gratification, certainly undergo the continual cycle of material existence. Steadiness in one's own position is declared to be piety. This is the definition being given. Whereas deviation from one's position is considered impiety. In this way, the two are defined, if definitely ascertained. A similar Uddhava, in order to understand what is proper in life, one must evaluate a given object within its particular category. And thus, in analyzing religious principles, one must consider purity and impurity. So purity in this definition is that which makes me more steady in my prescribed duty. And impurity is anything by this definition that makes me weaker in doing my service. This is not, as I said, Bhagavatam is not a moral text. When we talk of right and wrong, it's not in terms of morality. Christianity, right and wrong, is based on morality. And Hindu karma tantra, right and wrong, is based on profit. If it's right, you get a big profit. If it's wrong, you won't get so much. So you better do the right thing, you get a big reward. But here, right and wrong is based on dharma, on one's duty. Thus, in analyzing religious principles, one must consider purity and impurity. And similarly, in ordinary dealings, one must distinguish between good and bad. And to ensure one's physical survival, one must recognize that which is auspicious and inauspicious. So this responsibility rests on the shoulders of every one of us. We must do this. And if we feel, oh, that's too much for me, I don't want to do that, then we'll become, as this verse explains, absorbed in sense gratification. We will not be able to recognize ourselves. Even right now, we can't yet recognize ourselves. The first process of spiritual recognition is given by Srila Prabhupada, that we recognize in a generic, general way, I am a servant. I am a servant of Krishna. But the actual characteristics of me as a servant are not yet visible to us. When I say I, now, I mean my body. Here I am again, back with the body. You see, so until we actually become quite advanced, we can't go beyond the bodily identification. Here I am, I'm a servant of Krishna, and I'm a pujari. Here I am, I'm a servant of Krishna, and I do this service, this service, this service. But inwardly, an inner life has to develop. And in that inner life, we have to think, oh, I wonder what I would do if I was in Krishna Loka. I wonder what I would like to do. Now we don't even think like that. We think, oh, this is so exciting, that is so exciting, let me do this, let me do that. That's our outer life. But we have to learn to have an inner life. And in that inner life, when that inner life becomes tangible, then we can relinquish some of our material attachments on the outer life because we have something better. And this is the development of a higher taste. And so the Prabhupada gives us the formula, gives us the process, gives us the Bhagavatam. And sometimes we want the result without the hard work. This is a typical Kali Yuga phenomenon. We like the result, but we don't want to go through all that work. So then you get cheated. You don't get the result, and you don't get the hard work. You get a false result. And you see so many people in Kali Yuga, they get cheated. Even if they have a bona fide teacher, they cheat themselves. How many people came to Srila Prabhupada? Who could be more exalted? Who could be more capable of delivering to them? But then they thought for one reason or another, oh, there must be something else. There might be somewhere else I could be more satisfied. Let me have a look around. And so they restlessly wander out again, off back into the material world. And they pop up here and pop up there and go here and go there. But they don't recognize how foolish they are. They just got the greatest possible opportunity and they took it lightly. So please, as devotees, don't take your Krishna consciousness lightly. Don't take your service as we're doing it now with our body lightly. And understand, as Uddhava had to understand when he saw the gopis, oh, there are people so much more advanced than I am. The residents of Vrindavan are so much more advanced than I am. And did he feel glum? Did he feel like, oh, now I've lost all my enthusiasm? No, he didn't. He thought, that's amazing. I wish I could take the dust of their feet. But they're so humble because they're so advanced. They'd never give it. There's no way, and I can't even ask them because they won't give it to me. So I just wish, he thought, because he's so intelligent, he thought to himself, I just wish that I could be born as just a kind of a plant somewhere. Because they'll walk over me. Everybody will walk over me, and I'll automatically get the dust from their feet. So there's a place in Vrindavan near Kusum Sarovara. And there's a small plant that grows in that area very much. I don't know if it still does. Years before it was growing there. And people would say, this is the kind of plant that Uddhava wished to be. So everyone feels, Uddhava is there. So this was his desire. So we should learn from Uddhava. And if we can't, you see, here's the package. You must take the full package. If I can do it, I should do it. If I can't do it, I go and pray about it. And then I try and do it, and I say, anyway, I'm very sorry. And I become humble because I can't do it. And then I read the Bhagavatam, and then I get so much more insight. I become closer to doing it. And in this way, I'm taking steps on that path of the journey back to home. So I'll stop here. If anyone has any questions about this journey home, please ask. Any practical questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. aware of it.
Yes.
Could you suggest any practice or a picture which we can frame in our mind, if we can recall every day, to make us remember that?
Probably the best, just talking about what is available already, the best thing that we can repeat and meditate on, the prayers you say before you go on the altar. Are they called Bhuta Sudhi? You say, I am not, I am eternal, I don't, I, yeah. Yes. What do you say? Does anyone have this? Okay. Does anyone know those prayers? It's in the sort of deity worship handbook, but it's a prayer. Yes, please. What is it in English? And I'll tell you. I'm not a Brahmin. I'm not a Sudra. I'm not a Vaishya. Yes. I'm not a Sudra nor Vaishya. Neither am I a Brahmachari nor a Grihastha. Nor a Vanaprastha nor a Sannyasi. So, one second. So, there you see, that's what we ask when people say our spiritual identification. We say I'm a Brahmacharini. You have to, my children have grown up, I'm a Vanaprastha now. Oh, look, there's a Maharaj, he's coming in to pay obeisances. So we say these things because we're transforming this bodily identification. So this prayer says, I'm not those things. So then we could say, okay, I should say, I'm not any of those things, I'm a materialist. But no, we're going the right way, we're not going backwards. So we say, I'm not these things. I can't hear clearly. I identify myself only as the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of Lord Sri Krishna, the maintainer of the gopis. Why don't you meditate on that? Take that mantra. It's already been given. It's so powerful. Because and it's interesting. It's funny. I mean, not interesting, it's obvious, but it is interesting for an ordinary person that you say this before you go on the altar. Which means that before you go on the altar, instead of saying, I've got Brahman initiation, so therefore I'm working on the altar, you then, if we think like that, then we'll have to call it the pujari industry. Amidst all the other industries in the world, we have the pujari industry, and for that, here are the qualifications. You have to be a this, this, and this. No, it's actually that the qualification is before you walk in the door, you try, you strive to think, I'm not any of those things. I'm a servant of a servant of a servant of a servant of Krishna, the beloved and maintainer of the gopis. So that's the discipline of the deity worship, beginning right there. Yeah. Sometimes we take the mantras lightly. It's just like, for example, when you do Tulsi Aarti or you do Guru Puja or any of these samskara prayers, it's very helpful sometimes to take the prayers in English and look at them and refresh your understanding of what you're saying. And it's a very nice thing to do to go through word for word. Because then when you're singing them, because we're like parrots, right? We learn them. When you don't know them, you feel so inferior. Oh, everybody knows that song. I don't know that song. And you're looking, I wish I knew that song. I'd be really somewhere, establish myself. But then once you learn it, it goes into automatic, and then it just goes on. And you can be standing there going like this automatically, and the whole thing's going on. And you can go out the door and wherever you want. Back to bed if you like. Just keep your hands going like this. And so therefore, we have to always be present. So being present is actually simple. It's not like we need a new way. We need to refresh what we're doing. And it's very nice when you do it. It's funny, you can do it time and time again, and each time it's nice, because we're getting back to, oh yes, and we feel a release of energy each time you do it. Because as it becomes automatic, the material nature starts to sort of pound on our head, we don't feel very lustful, we feel desires coming in, we feel a bit exhausted and a bit grumpy and, you know, not so happy with, you know, Krishna consciousness, and it's difficult, and don't know about the rest of the devotees, I don't think they're doing very well either, and so on. And then if we just do a refresh, it's like when your computer jams, right? Like Koti, and you turn it off, you turn it on again. There it is, and it does it better. So we need to know these techniques. One time somebody told me something that I thought was very profound. They told me that the reason that Krishna, you were able to become Krishna conscious, you, yourself, ourselves, and so forth, when Srila Prabhupada came to the West, was because you were not offensive. You think, not offensive? And they said, you were just grossly sinful. So grossly sinful is different than offensive. Just like even with Jagai and Madai, there was something they did that allowed them to get the mercy of Krishna. They weren't offensive. They were grossly sinful, the most sinful. They did so many horrible things. So we did so many horrible things that we don't really feel worthy of being called not offensive. But offenses are performed when you're dealing directly with Vaishnavas. And sins go on when you're dealing with everybody and everything else. So of course, in another technical term, you can say you can offend ordinary people as well. So it depends on the use of the term offend. But here, the use is this aparat, is when we start to offend each other. And so this person said, so you were able to come and make advancement and so on, but when you offend each other, then that's when your spiritual life stops. It gets very difficult to maintain. And there's a verse in the Bhagavatam that supports this, that explains like that, that when there's fighting between devotees, Krishna doesn't take offense, because he's always, it's clear between us and him, ironically. It explains Krishna doesn't become disturbed, but because there's friction between the devotees have to suffer. And Prabhupada says in one of his very sweet, positive ways, and that is only for some time. But something will be there. So living together, one might then say, okay, that's a good idea. I shouldn't live with the devotees, because it's difficult to live with the devotees. Let me live by myself. And I become, what do you think? Gradually, grossly sinful again. So that's compared to if somebody's drowning in a river. They're in the middle of the river and they're going down and they're drowning. And they decide to swim to the shore. But as you're trying to struggle to the shore, the current right on the edge of the bank is swifter and heavier than in the middle of the ocean. So therefore the person in their desperation might say, let me just swim back to the middle of the river. But what will happen then? They'll drown. So better to give it a go and try to get to the shore, even though it's difficult. And this is true living with devotees. Better to try to become unoffensive somehow. And here is the process, the Bhagavatam, these mantras, the sadhana bhakti, the sankirtan, the service. So all these things, when our mind is disturbed, we have to say, as my husband says to me so many times in a day, he says, what are you supposed to be doing right now? He says, what is your service? And my mind is gone, what's this? And look at that, and what about that? So like a child, what is your service? Oh, thank you. And we go back on with your service. And this is training. It's not that because we say this, we can immediately do this. Over and again, we won't be able to do it. But that's like swimming. You may not get there immediately, but you have no choice than to go to the land if you want to be safe. So we have no choice than to undergo the difficulties that come, by living together, when we tend, because we were previously grossly sinful, to now become offensive, we have no choice than to try to overcome that and to continue to try to serve Krishna and reach the shore of the material world where we're going to be so happy and we're going to say to ourselves, thank you so much that you continued on with the task. So that's what we must do. We encourage each other like that. But just continue. It's not easy. We know it's not easy. It's very difficult. We know it's very difficult. But it's in your interest to continue to make advancement until you get to safety. Any other questions? Any other points? Yes. Yes. Yes.
So I understand that I have to see that really bad.
Yes.
Such a tricky thing to say.
It's very tricky. It's very tricky. It's very difficult. It's explaining back to this verse where Krishna is telling Arjuna to see good and bad. He says you have to evaluate a given object within a particular category. So that's interesting, because that adds something. Because good and bad, if I say, okay, she's good, she's bad, he's good, he's bad, you're good, you're bad. You know, that's not very healthy to do that. But our power of discrimination doesn't sort of cut off, if you understand what I mean. So I can't see good and bad, so I don't know what's going on. Evaluation doesn't necessarily mean moral good and moral bad. It has to be in terms of pious and impious according to our particular category, our own dharma. So I might say, I don't think it's really so good for me to associate with so-and-so. And it's not because so-and-so is a monster. It's because when I associate with that person, I get distracted from what I'm supposed to be doing. And there, you don't give a moral judgment of that person. You're giving two things. You're saying, I get distracted, so there's some self-awareness, and that of what I'm supposed to be doing. So it's vastly different than the mental good and bad, she's good, she's bad process. And it modifies that process, because that's a habit of nature in the material world. We had to always say good and bad, even if we were inaccurate, because we were protecting ourselves. But now Krishna is our protector, so therefore we have to think in terms of his service. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Have to use discretion.
Have to use discretion, yes. And it can't be labelled bad. It has to be that that's not very helpful to me. And then if you of course there also you can say, oh, I'm sorry, Mangalati is not very helpful to me. But then you have to be also intelligent in your discretion. And then, okay, Mangalati is not very helpful to me. Okay, what's my pious and impious? Pious is when I'm strictly following my service. Impious is when I'm weak in my service. Does Mangalati help me be stronger? And sometimes, on very extreme circumstances, it may be that because of this, and this, I shouldn't go to Mangalati. But obviously, that's an extreme situation whereby, say, I have to do something else. My service is something different. I have to chant my rounds then because I'm doing this service, because I'm doing this. So we have to, all the time, be using our discretion and not putting things into categories that are immovable because they will change. It's a problem. Yes, exactly. But I think all of us have the experience that when we chant good rounds, our immediately, because we need an immediate fix, you know, if something's difficult, we want it fixed. You chant your rounds well, your power of discernment becomes more subtle and more refined. And so on the days that you chant good quality rounds, you automatically feel a release of the tensions that occur when you're struggling with your mind and your power of discernment in a particular situation. Both will be there. Good point. Thank you. Any other points? It looks like everybody here except you is a very good devotee, practicing everything very nicely, no problems. Oh, another person with a problem. Yes, Prabhu.
You know that separation
is very powerful. Yes. So there is an inner reason and an outer reason. The inner reason is his own personal taste. The outer reason is because we're all already in separation and it's so painful. The inner reason is that Krishna is able to see and experience the love that Srimati Radharani has for him. So that makes him the object of the love. Now, here's a cup. It's the object of my picking it up. The cup can't pick me up because it's the object. I'm the person who did it. So Radharani has this extraordinary love, and her love is so great that she conquers Krishna. She defeats him every time. Because he's giving to Radharani that she'll be able to give more. Because Krishna's giving to everyone, right? And Radharani's only giving to one person. So everything of Radha is for Krishna, but Krishna, he has to serve in Dwarka, he has to serve in Mathura, he has to serve. He has to answer all the prayers of all the people down here praying to him, he has to attend. So, of course, this is a rustic understanding, not a literal understanding. So he's loving everyone, but Radharani is only loving him. And she gives everything for his pleasure because she's his pleasure person. So Krishna wants to experience it. What's it like? And this is the one thing he can't experience. But he can experience it. But he can't experience it as Krishna. Because he's the cup. She's the hand. So what does he do? He comes again. He takes the mood of Radha. He comes as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to taste her love. And so this is why the Chaitanya Chaitamrita is very, very extraordinary and very difficult for a scholarly person to understand from the scholarly point of view, because they have to understand this secret, and only a devotee can understand this, because it's so inner. And they can understand the outer, but they can't understand this because they don't know about, they don't know Krishna. They only know. It is Radha and Krishna combined, so they're in union. But in union, Krishna wants to taste, because when Krishna's not there, Radharani's love goes to the highest point when Krishna's not there. And that highest point is explained by Lord Chaitanya in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that when Krishna is present, just like we get a little tiny, tiny shadow idea of it, that if you had somebody, say you have a child and you love them very much, when they're with you, you feel very happy. They're with me, their well-being is there, everything's very nice. If they were to go overseas and be in a car accident, if you think your concern for them would go so high, and all day you'd be thinking about them, where are they? What are they doing now? Are they all right? You'd be ringing up, you'd be doing... It would intensify your care and love for them, because you can't actually reach out and help them right there. They're at a distance. So this is just a sort of a little tiny hint. So when Krishna and Radha are together, Radha gives everything to Krishna. But when Krishna leaves, who is she going to give it to? He's not there, so she's constantly, where is Krishna, where is Krishna, where is Krishna? As Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was doing. And he would beat his head on the side of the room. They would lock him in at night. Because he goes away in the night, out into the night, looking, where is Krishna, where is Krishna? And they lock three doors. And they come, and he's gone. And they all go out, all over Jagannath Puri in the moonlight, finding him. Where is he? And when they find him, he's in such an internal, intense state that his body has transformed into a form that we would think would be grotesque and horrible. His limbs have elongated, or his limbs have actually retreated within his body. So what is he experiencing? We cannot imagine that his body transforms like that. this Krishna experiencing these loving moods of separation. So what did Radharani experience when Krishna left? And why does Krishna leave like that? He leaves to glorify the wonderful love of Radha and to intensify it. And that's inconceivable, because it's already unlimited. So how can you go beyond unlimited? But Radharani's love goes beyond unlimited and continues to increase. These are conceptions of the spiritual world. They're not available here. We can't really, we can only make very, very indistinct saying, just like, just like, just like. I probably say just like the sun. The sun is giving out so much heat every day, but still it's increasing and increasing in its heat. It's like as if unlimited. Although the sun has a limitation. But Radharani's love has no limitation. So Krishna, he wanted to feel that, experience that. How high her love goes. That was what was on the inside. So the first half of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's preaching, he's preaching Harinam Sankirtan. He's giving that for the world. And it describes, there's a verse in the Madhya Lila describes that he wove a garland of prema bhakti in the holy name, and he gives this to the world. And you please take this chanting, and it will take you up to this highest position. It will. And Srila Prabhupada would assure us of that, this. If you take this path, it will take you to there. But to get there, we have to do our work now. If we say it's a long journey, so I'm going to walk slowly. It's illogical, you won't say you'll take so long, and then you'll get bored, and then you'll become mischievous again. So please don't do that. Please walk steadily in the present, walk to the future, and continue walking on this journey back to the most extraordinary place. The Prabhupada will be there to help you. Anything else? Alright, then we should start our day of bhakti, devotional activities, and try to integrate into today anything that you've heard, and that will make it yours. Otherwise, it's somebody else's. So please do that and be happy. Thank you. Hare Krishna.